Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. An interesting variety of subject matter for our legal roundtable panel on today's program. It'll range from an unusual Missouri case before the U.S. Supreme Court to that Missouri painting that's been bouncing around the halls and walls of the U.S. Capitol. That and the new Missouri governor's answer for the so-called St. Louis legal hellhole. And the man nominated to become the next U.S. Attorney General finds himself in an unusual position when it comes to confirming fellow nominees. In studio to talk about it, our attorneys Mark Smith, Associate Vice Chancellor of Students at Washington University. He also directs the Career Center there. Bill Freivogel is Professor of Journalism at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. And Rachel Sachs is with us for the first time. She is an Associate Professor at Washington University School of Law. Nice to have you all with us. Thanks so much. And Rachel, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Well, we're going to put you on the spot right at the very beginning. Because Your area of expertise primarily is in health law, as I understand it. And I'd like to get your take on this executive order that our brand new president has just signed with regard to Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. What's your take on that and the likely impact?
Right. So on Friday, one of President Trump's first actions was to issue a very confusing executive order on the subject of the Affordable Care Act. Now, you don't have to take my word for that. Yesterday, Senator Susan Collins came out and said, quote, "I think that the executive order is very confusing." But basically what it says is that to the maximum extent permitted by law, the Secretary of HHS and remember, we don't have one of those yet, should take any action they can to waive or defer provisions of the Act to provide flexibility to states. So for now, nothing has changed. The executive order doesn't do anything on its own. It tells agency heads who don't yet exist to take unspecified actions to weaken the ACA. But there are a range of things it could do. So there's a blog I enjoy reading called The Incidental Economist, and Michigan law professor Nick Bagley and Harvard PhD student Adriana McIntyre came up with a list of more than 25 things HHS could do to weaken the law. And that ranges from isolated changes like eliminating preventive services for women to broader changes like declining to enforce the individual mandate, which was something that came up on Sunday's talk shows. And honestly, the really big problem with the executive order is the uncertainty it creates in the market. So pretty soon, insurers are going to have to start coming up with their plans for 2018 because of the ways in which the timing works. And they need certainty. They need to know what the rules are going to be for next year. And so President Trump, if he does move forward with some of these actions through the new HHS secretary, he may do what he said he won't do, which is crash the markets, take health insurance away from tens of millions who currently have it.
But is it set up in such a way, even though it is confusing, that it could totally unravel the Affordable Care Act?
It would take time to do that, and there would be legal challenges to a number of the proposals that the HHS secretary might put forth. The real danger is that insurers would look at what the administration is doing and they would say, we have no idea whether we're going to be able to be profitable in such a market. We're going to pull out of the exchanges. It would have less of an effect on the Medicaid expansion. They can do less to that to crash it. But in terms of the individual markets, there's a lot the president can do on his own to really weaken that part of the law.
Any other thoughts, Bill and Mark?
Well, just I would say, you know, Obama had issued some executive orders kind of saying when we're implementing the ACA, let's be generous about granting waivers and, you know, letting it. So in some ways, some commentators, and I think Bagley, the one you, I think that's his name, yeah, that you mentioned, was kind of warning about this because if you get a different president, to me, this seems more like a political thing. It's basically Trump saying to his supporters, look, I'm coming after. But we would, if they're going to change regulations, they have to abide by the Administrative Procedure Act. If they're going to change the law, that has to go through Congress. So to me, this is Trump saying to all his supporters, look, I'm going after Obamacare, and saying to the agencies, you got my permission to anything you can do to undercut Obamacare. But I think you're exactly right. It creates a lot of uncertainty for business people And business people don't like uncertainty. They like to know what's going to happen so they know what to do.
But through executive order, Bill, the president can only nibble at the edges of this thing. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it really affects the amount of discretion that the federal officials use. One reason that they can maybe have a greater effect than they would otherwise is that the Obama administration itself used fairly broad discretion in the way they interpreted the law. So now Trump can sort of claim that same kind of broad discretion in trying to undo some of these things.
This is something I think many people don't fully understand or comprehend, and that is you have a law that has been passed by Congress, and you have a president issuing executive orders. Can executive orders do anything more than, as I suggest, nibble at the edges or just kind of undermine various aspects of the actual law?
Well, they can set priorities, right? So to the degree that the ACA, it's enormously complex. It instructs the different agencies to do an enormous range of things. And the president can simply say, this is not going to be our enforcement priority right now. We're not going to, you know, enforce the individual mandate to the degree that we were. And that undermines an enormous amount of the stability of the exchanges.
Yeah, and there are things like some of the the House had challenged some of the subsidies that the Obama administration was paying, and I believe they won a lower court decision there. Well, if the federal government just decides not to appeal, then they would presumably have discretion to maybe not pay those subsidies, which are important ones. You know, we've talked before about the contraceptive mandate as it relates to some religiously affiliated organizations or religious hospitals. And, you know, that's something, too, where they can use their discretion to not enforce, I think, well, to at least pull back on the Obama administration's position on enforcement of that contraceptive mandate.
I mean, people want things to be simple, but they're not simple. You have this very complicated law, and even though it's a huge mammoth set of pages, it doesn't cover every situation. So then under the delegation doctrine, agencies have to interpret it. They go through this whole process that they have to go through, and they come up with more stuff. And then, like you said, then the president can come in and say, okay, well, we can't do all these things, so let's do these things first. And so it's not, you know, I mean, to undo Obamacare is going to take completely is going to take congressional action. We haven't gotten that yet.
Repeal and replace.
So, yes.
We haven't gotten to that
point. We're going nowhere fast on that one.
Yeah, yeah. Is this on a track, as you could see it now, to possibly go back before the Supreme Court?
I mean, the answer has to be yes, right? Yeah. We don't know how or why.
No. But it's not going to just end with an executive order. Or even with their replacement.
No, this didn't kill it. This is just slowing it down a little bit, I think.
Yeah, I guess we'll have to see what the replacement is once Congress passes that.
And how many people are affected by that and who has standing to file suit, et cetera, and so forth.
I suppose that if people feel as though they – some sort of action by the Trump administration under an executive order, you know, keeps them from having something to which they are entitled under the Affordable Care Act, that they might have some sort of claim they could make that could go up the court system. But it's really too early to see exactly how that's going to play out, I think.
Yeah, I think part of the problem right now is that things are so unsettled in Congress. You know, there are half a dozen, maybe by this point close to a dozen Republican plans for replacement kicking around, but none of them have real majority support, and the House and the Senate are in very different places politically on what they're interested in. So, you know, Paul Ryan really wants to reform Medicare, but that's not going anywhere in the Senate just yet. So I will stay tuned like everyone else.
Right.
But
and plus, we've got the president, and we don't know what he wants. I mean, he's kind of said it, but he said a lot of different things. We haven't seen legislation.
Short on detail, yeah, I think is one way to put it. We have a caller who wants to get in to this part of the discussion. Let's take Dennis's call from Overland. Dennis, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Thank you. And I just feel that in terms of the Affordable Care Act, not enough emphasis has been put on the yearly caps and the lifetime caps, obviously the whole idea of no more pre-existing conditions is people like that. But I think the fact that 20 million people or whatever have health care now that have never had it before has been talked about. But everybody, every one of you guys right there and gals, and myself included, we do benefit from the idea of yearly caps and lifetime caps being gone. And it propels people into bankruptcy. And you can be very wealthy and all of a sudden find yourself losing everything.
Dennis, so thanks for the call. Rachel.
Dennis, thank you for that comment. So this is so important, right? One thing the ACA did was to remove some of these lifetime and yearly caps where someone would have a particular, you know, about with cancer and then not be able to be covered a lot very much going forward, or children who have to spend a lot of time in the hospital, you know, maybe there's a premature birth, those kinds of situations. It could really be harmful to families, bankruptcies, and things like that. And so to the degree that a lot of these replacement plans would put some of those caps back, it's definitely something to watch and something to be concerned about.
I mean, all along, some of the individual elements of Obamacare have been quite popular, you know, like the pre-existing condition, no pre-existing condition.
Kids on the plan.
Parents till 26. But, you know, in opinion polls, it has not been overall had majority support until, ironically, the last poll I saw right about the time of the inauguration, if for the first time the entire act had majority support in the country, just as the Republicans have now gained enough political leverage to get rid of it.
The ACA has a majority support, but Obamacare does not.
Right, yes. Right. Correct.
And I think when you talk to people who would identify as Trump supporters, their issues with Obamacare, at least what I heard from my friends who was either – I don't like the government telling me what to do, but part of the reason for making people get insurance was so we could lower the cost, capture all those people who didn't have high needs, who were willing to take some risk. We got to bring those into the pool. And then the other argument was, well, I got my insurance. My insurance has gone up. Yeah. I mean, health insurance has been going up for the last 20 years, and I don't know that the new president's going to have a silver bullet to fix that problem. And so, and particularly if we take all these healthy people and let them come out, I see prices going up even
more. Although, have you seen, you know, a lot of these proposals would replace the individual mandate, which is the most hated part of the act, with auto enrollment, which in some ways is even more draconian.
Yeah, right. That's a good point.
I have to take a break, but very quickly, and Rachel, I'll come back to you on this. We've been hearing all day today that the proposed merger between Humana and Aetna has been scotched. That's a pretty big deal. How does that play into this whole thing, or does it?
Yeah, it's a very big deal, and one of the most interesting things about it is that the judge explicitly referred to attempts to pull out of the individual marketplaces as arguing against some of these efficiencies that we were seeing. So it's a big deal in terms of preserving provider competition, competition among insurers. And then I will be interested to see what President Trump's response to that is, because he has gone on record making his own statements about competition and the importance of these big companies being able to achieve the efficiencies that they want.
Yeah. Well, obviously, we're going to be talking about this for a while, at least for a while. Have to take a break already. Let's do that now. Come back. We'll continue with other subjects with our Legal Roundtable panelists. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back. We'll be continuing our Legal Roundtable panel discussion today. You're hearing this for the first time, as I am, ladies and gentlemen, about the Chief Justice Breckinridge calling for that review of how long people are held in jail. Any thoughts about that, or is it too fresh?
Well, of course, that relates very much to the whole Ferguson story and the abuses that municipal holdovers and municipal courts have been involved in North St. Louis County, something that you know, Thomas Harvey of Arch City refers to as, and others refer to as, the Muni Court Shuffle, where a person gets stopped and they haven't been to court to pay their fine, and they're put into a holdover, and then no sooner do they get that one taken care of, and there's a bench warrant in some neighboring municipality, and they get transferred over there. Meanwhile, they lose their job, their family's not able to pay the rent. So this can have a very destructive effect on people, and these are people who have not committed a crime.
Well, so she has addressed that.
I think
she,
it's a good step by that.
And it's been in the – like you said, it's been in the news a lot. I think it'll – I mean, but I got to say, you know, this is changing the subject a little bit, but I'm a little concerned about – you know, we had the Ferguson – the consent decree, which is an agreement between the Justice Department and Ferguson. We've got a new administration coming, a new attorney general eventually. I mean, they've already got the agreement, but – I mean, I wonder if they couldn't renegotiate that agreement. And that agreement was – a big part of it was dealing with exactly these issues that Breckinridge was talking about. And will the change mechanism kind of slow down?
And how will the legislature react to the Chief Justice? Okay, let's move on. This is a case that we've talked about before, and that is the – now the Supreme Court has this Missouri case – concerning money to a religious institution. This concerns the playground. It was a church playground, rubberized pellets being used to soften the falls of the youngsters who were playing on the playground. The state has balked at providing funds for this now, claiming it's a conflict between state and church. Anyone have any thoughts on that that case?
Well, yes. So Missouri is one of many states that has a so-called Blaine Amendment provision providing for separation of church and state. It's called the Blaine Amendment because Blaine was a person who proposed a stricter separation of church and state in the late 1800s, ran for president unsuccessfully. But a lot of states passed those amendments. So Missouri's amendment on separation of church and state is stronger than the First Amendment's establishment clause. So what was involved here was there was this program that made recycled tires available as rubberized playground equipment. Trinity Lutheran Church and our daycare center in Columbia applied for that rubberized material. It was rated like the fourth best application. 14 applications were funded. It was not, however, because it was a church, a church institution, and that was seen as violating this Blaine Amendment provision of the Missouri Constitution. And so now it's, as you say, before the U.S. Supreme Court. And I think it's – we'll see. We'll see what happens. But it's you know, particularly after Trump adds a person to that Supreme Court, it's quite possible that they'll say that the daycare center should be able to obtain those materials, and maybe that the Blaine Amendment provision is not constitutional. We'll see about that.
And that goes back to 1870, in the 1870s, I think.
But there's a very strange thing about this case, which is that it seems to be fully briefed and ready for argument. Yeah. It's been ready since the summer, but the court hasn't scheduled it for argument. And so I think there are a couple of possibilities. I think one is our own change in state government. So, you know, Attorney General Koster had taken one position that Trinity Lutheran couldn't get the funds, but our new AG Hawley has a different position. So maybe the court is expecting some sort of, you know, letter from the administration saying we've decided to you know, leave the case, and we'll see what it does in that situation. But another is that this is one of a handful of cases that are fully briefed that the court has not scheduled for argument, maybe because it thinks it'll be divided 4-4. There's a case I'm watching as a property law professor about eminent domain in Wisconsin, which has also not been scheduled. So, you know, we have to wait on these, but it'll be very interesting to see what the court, when they finally schedule it. Yes.
And this Trinity Lutheran case, I mean, at its core, I think it's this inherent conflict that's in the amendment about religious freedom. It, on the one hand, you can't support any religion. So the argument is, so we can't give money to this church because we'd be supporting a religion. And if they have extra money then because they didn't have to put these tire things or protect their playground, they'd go out and buy more Bibles and or do whatever they do. But then versus you can't discriminate against any religion. So we're saying, oh, anyone can come and get these ground up tires, but you, because you're a religious guy, you can't get it. And there's a tension there. And so, I mean, the arguments that I've heard that I thought were kind of interesting, on the one, it's, you know, it's not like we're denying fire coverage to them, you know, but this is, but in, on the other hand, we are denying them something where there's a limited resource and we can only give it to so many people. And we're going to say, we're going to give it to non-religious people. So if I had to guess, that's where I would come down, but I'm not sure.
But Rachel, what you said is a reminder that elections do have consequences.
Huge.
And there was an interesting front page story in the Post-Dispatch this morning in which the head of the state GOP was kind of lamenting the fact that at the moment, the GOP, although it's dominant statewide here in politics, is really not dominant in the courts because the majorities have been appointed by Democrats. So that's like is going to change, though, quickly because there is a vacancy in the Supreme Court here.
Yeah,
right.
Unfortunately.
Yes.
Well, just Judge Teitelman was such a pillar of the community.
I think we all agree on that. So that's the vacancy is from Judge Teitelman's death. You know, I think what the Republican Party leader is saying is he fears that some of this legislation that they're about to get through on, you know, tort reform, the recently passed voter ID.
Right to work.
That all those things could be subject to being thrown out by a Missouri Supreme Court. Now, you know, my general sense is that the Missouri Supreme Court, without Judge Teitelman, and with a replacement for Judge Teitelman, isn't going to be a liberal bastion, but
it would
but
be
we'll
4-3.
Still 4-3 Democrat. Yeah. Right.
All right. Well, let's move on to something else here. The last program that we were involved with here with our Legal Roundtable panel concerned an American Tort Reform Foundation survey that named St. Louis as a number one judicial hellhole in the country, because courts generally rule for generous awards to plaintiffs. Governor Greitens took note of this in his State of the State address. Let's hear what he had to say.
There was a report released about a month ago that looked at every state, every city, and every county in the United States. And that report named St. Louis, Missouri, as the worst judicial hellhole in America. This isn't a pretty picture. Here's what's happening. Out-of-state lawyers are suing businesses on behalf of out-of-state clients in Missouri's courts. We're the place where the nastiest lawyers come to do work so dirty and engage in lawsuits so murky they wouldn't pass muster anywhere else. What does this do? It scares away businesses. It means fewer jobs and smaller paychecks. The companies intimidated by this shady practice, they have customers here. They could make even more money here, but they're afraid to expand their business here. In Missouri, trial lawyers can sue people in the state of Missouri, and because of how broken the system is, if they win just $1 for their clients, they still get paid huge legal fees. For too long in this state, trial lawyers have picked our people's pockets, and it's time to do different. It's time to do different.
Governor Eric Greitens, during his State of the State address, I think it's fair to say that he's worked up about this.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, this judicial hellhole story is like one of my least, as a journalist, is one of my least favorite stories. Yeah. I mean, you know, the governor was talking about this as if it's a report. It's just like, maybe unbiased report. This is the corporate defendants who are saying that they don't like losing so many cases in St. Louis. So, you know, this judicial hellhole thing is just really a very masterful corporate effort to decrease the judgments against them in places like St. Louis. I mean, I'm not saying that there probably are some points that one could make, like they want to pass a new a new standard for how you judge expert witnesses. You know, maybe that is something for which you could make a decent argument. But overall, this sort of broad brush judicial hellhole approach is really misleading.
And one thing I find fascinating about it is that a number of states, localities, federal district courts have gone the opposite direction, where they're trying to make themselves plaintiff-friendly to draw a business to their jurisdiction. So for intellectual property lawyers, I need only say Eastern District of Texas, and they will get the message, right? If you can create rules that are friendly to plaintiffs, you can increase the number of cases that are brought there. And some may see this is a bad thing, but others see it as a good thing. So it's a different perspective.
What kind of business is being drummed up? I mean, hotel rooms for attorneys coming into town?
Hotel
that sort
rooms,
of thing?
Local councils, restaurants. So St. Louis has enough. You know, certainly St. Louis is doing well along other dimensions. This isn't about drawing business to small towns
with
no DACA.
Centers of bankruptcy filings,
yes.
Too. And you bring in all the creditors, lawyers, and it's a lot of people, it could be a lot of money. The other thing, just
not
to go
the
back,
World Series, though.
No, it's not the World Series, but it's just as exciting to us.
I think it's better.
Yeah. But what Grimes was saying, if I heard him right, he said, what's happening is we're bringing plaintiffs, out-of-state plaintiffs, to Missouri. Well, if that's what he's worried about, that case would get removed from state court to federal court. And then whatever we do, I mean, you still have state law that would govern, but federal procedural law would govern the procedures. So I agree completely with what you said about this judicial hellhole. That's just marketing. It's just a snappy name they've given for people who don't like to lose,
well,
and nobody
this,
does.
This outfit, the American Tort Reform Foundation, is somewhat suspect. I've received a number of emails.
It's a great name, though.
Yeah, it is.
But apparently bends to the will, Bill, as you suggested, to the corporate.
Funded by the corporate defendant.
Yes. But the title, Rich Corporations That Don't Like to Lose, that doesn't have as much panache as tort reform.
When you say something like judicial hellhole, it's going to be picked up in every paper, every broadcast throughout the state and other states as well.
And the folks over in Madison County are going to begin to be a little bit jealous that St. Louis is getting the judicial hellhole attention and not they. They're the usual targets of that.
Yeah. The governor does have a proposal for dealing with this. Very quickly, let's deal with that.
We need, for example, to move to the Daubert standard for expert witness testimony. Right now, our standards are far too low. By moving to the Daubert standard, we'd be adopting the same standards used by the federal government and 39 other states.
All righty, Governor Greitens again during the State of the State address. What the heck is the Daubert standard?
Well, it's named after I believe, a Supreme Court case. And as the governor said, it's the federal standard. Three-quarters of the states use it. Missouri is amongst the quarter that does not. It makes it harder to admit expert witness testimony. It puts it in the hands of the judge, the trial judge, to determine whether the expert witness's testimony relates to, say, peer-reviewed science, to whether or not it's science that has gotten generally been accepted by the majority in the field. There's a list of about four different factors for the judge to consider. So it makes it harder to get an expert witness certified to testify.
But does it? So this is my question. It's not as if Missouri has no standards about expert witness qualifications. It does have standards. So I guess my question is sort of how many expert witnesses are we currently qualifying who would be disqualified under Daubert? And you know, I don't have a principled objection to switching to Daubert necessarily, but does it really matter? Is it more of a talking point? I mean, as a lawyer, this is like hearing Chevron deference mentioned in the State of the State.
Yeah,
it's very exciting.
Right.
But I'm just wondering, what do we have a sense of what the impact might be here in practice?
Yeah, I don't.
I don't either.
But he apparently does.
Well,
at least he has a feeling.
Our Yeah. It sounds good.
Yeah. Well, right. This has been a long effort. I mean, for example, I think there was a bill last year that would have made this change, and it was either vetoed or threatened to be vetoed by Nixon. So it's something they've been trying to get passed for some time.
Before we take our next break, let's bring in Creighton, who is calling from Clayton on this particular issue. We'll get his take on this. Go ahead, Creighton. You're on the air.
Well, I actually wanted to take it a step back to Governor Greitens talking about some of the consumer protection laws in Missouri, particularly the Merchandising Practices Act. I know you were just discussing the Daubert standard, but if you look at the – I just guess want to make sure everyone's aware that if you look at the bill that's currently in front in committee in the Missouri legislature, it will essentially remove, as far as I can see, the vast majority of protections that Missouri consumers now have. And you also made a comment about the – or I guess Governor Greitens did – about suing for $1 – and getting attorney's fees. And one of the reasons we have the Merchandising Practices Act is the very reason that a lawyer is disincentivized to take a contingency case for a small amount of money, whereas if you have a law like the Merchandising Practices Act, a small amount of money in attorney's fees can be shifted so that the defendant pays them. The small amount of money could be actually actionable. So it really does a great job of protecting consumers in Missouri. And the law that's currently being proposed would do a basically destroy it, as far as I can see.
Creighton, thank you for the call. Anyone want to respond to Creighton's comments?
Sounds like that's a great call. Thank you for calling.
And Creighton, as I understand it, is a lawyer, so presumably he knows what he's talking about.
Sounds like he does.
Okay, bite your tongue down. I have to take a break. We'll do that and come back and continue this conversation. Our legal roundtable panel stays with us. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back. As we continue our legal roundtable panel discussion, we have lots of things to talk about here. I was going through the list, going to have to edit as we go along. I wanted to talk about that controversial painting that has been on and again and off again the walls at the Capitol building. Congressman Clay is involved in this. It's a contest-winning painting, which critics say it demeans cops. And it's a First Amendment issue. I'm not quite sure how I get that, but maybe you do, Bill.
Well, I mean, there's a central principle of the First Amendment, which is you cannot discriminate against something based on viewpoint.
The government can't. Right.
The government can't discriminate based on viewpoint. And so an argument could be made that, that Ryan's office and the architect of the Capitol are discriminating against this painting based upon its viewpoint. The argument on the other side is that, well, this painting was chosen as part of a congressional art competition, and that congressional art competition has rules that say, well, we don't want art that's involving sort of controversial stuff. And this clearly did. I mean, that in itself it seems like sort of a viewpoint restriction. But I mean, the government in the past has said that in cases involving like the NEA and grants to artists, that the government could enforce a decency standard for when it gives grants to artists. So I think there's an argument to be made on both sides of this issue.
Any other thoughts?
No.
Let's move ahead. The St. Louis Board of Aldermen is working on adding to an anti-discrimination ordinance. If approved, the bill would add pregnancy and reproductive health decisions to the city's anti-discrimination ordinance alongside protections existing on race, sex, or disability. The state is considering legislation would essentially blunt that and roadblock it. Because it would add reproductive health decisions to that ordinance. What do you make of this, Rachel?
Well, on its face, I think the ordinance is a great idea. I'm just very confused because I thought employers would already be covered under Title VII and most landlords under the Fair Housing Act here, and I'll say what I mean by that. We often think about pregnancy discrimination, which is one of the things this ordinance would do, as being already covered under discrimination on the basis of sex. So an employer who discriminates against a woman because she's pregnant or has been pregnant, that's unlawful sex discrimination. And at least some courts have held that discrimination against women who have had abortions or who take contraception also qualifies as pregnancy discrimination under Title VII. So it's all a little bit recursive. So I'm interested in what because it's my understanding that we already ban discrimination on the basis of sex. It's interesting to me what this would add in addition to that. So can anyone
What if they said the question on the application was, do you use birth control of any type? So for a man, you know, I have to say whether or not I use condoms or if I've had any kind of surgical procedure. And women, and we say we're not going to accept anyone because it violates. Now, I still think under the religion exception, they could do that. But I mean, but this would, wouldn't this? That would apply to both men and women.
Is there a religious objection to both parts of this, the pregnancy discrimination as well as the contraceptive decisions?
That wasn't clear to me whether the archdiocese was objecting to both or not. I mean, I think the answer to your, Rachel, to your other question is why do we need this if we already have the federal law? The potential answer to that is sometimes it's easier, sometimes local or state civil rights laws are broader.
The remedies
are better. Mm-hmm. Right. So, like, we have a state human rights law that makes racial and sex discrimination illegal, and that's important because you can win bigger judgments in Missouri state court than you can in a federal court.
Because we're a judicial hellhole.
Because we're a judicial hellhole.
Yes, I would love to know what the remedies provisions are like, because it is hard to win cases under Title VII.
Yeah. But also under state law, it's hard to win those discrimination cases, I think. And then the city of St. Louis also prohibits discrimination based on sexual orientation, which is not covered by state or federal law. Mm-hmm. So this is the additional remedy that you're talking about, the additional protection, right?
Well, the legislation has not yet been finalized in Jefferson City, but there is also the parent of the legislators are saying that the city ordinance would inhibit free speech. Hello?
Well, I mean, I think they mean like they probably are meaning it sort of broadly in terms of like religious freedom, free speech to, you know. I mean, I can see the argument that if you're that a Catholic school should be, you know, have within its power under the First Amendment religious freedom to not hire a woman who is had an abortion. I think that probably is.
But they can. They also have the
First.
They also, they already have the power. If I'm a Catholic school and I don't want to hire a Presbyterian, I can do that. Even though, they're protected there. So going back to what does this give? If that's the people now, I guess it would. If I'm not a religious organization, I just want to then come in and say I don't want any people using birth control because I just don't think it's right. Unrelated to religion, maybe I wouldn't be protected. I don't know.
Or is it about free speech in terms of what employers can ask about? Right, Mark, as you just said, can they ask about whether someone takes contraception or has had an abortion? Because there are lots of things we don't allow employers to ask about. Mm-hmm. And generally those have I don't know if they've been subject to free speech challenges, but we don't allow employers to ask questions about things quite often. So
yeah, but that's because then they could be sued for discrimination.
Yes, exactly. Well,
yeah.
Right.
So the Council for the Archdiocese said that the bill violated the rights of religious groups that don't want to be complicit in abortion and other practices they find unethical. And he thought it could also force Catholic organizations to include contraceptive coverage in their health insurance plans.
We ought to acknowledge before moving on, by the way, that President Trump issued another executive order yesterday on abortions, blocking foreign aid or federal funding for international non-governmental organizations that provide or promote abortions. I don't know if there's anything to say on that, but that's another. Go ahead, Rachel.
I'll say two things. One is that this is not new or unexpected. Yeah. This has been going back and forth in every Republican and Democratic administration. Republican administrations institute this, which is called the global gag rule. Democratic administrations get rid of it. And then the only other thing I'll say is that there's been some misinformation going around, including, it seems like, yesterday in Press Secretary Spicer's conference. This is not about the U.S. government directly funding abortions. This is about the U.S. government funding organizations, which themselves use other funding to carry out abortions or advocate for them.
Right. So this is called, as Rachel says, this started with Ronald Reagan, 1984. It's called the Mexico City Rule. And it does, you know, it has, I think it does have a big effect on women in other parts of the world, where a substantial portion of women in other parts of the world who die in childbearing years die from illegal abortions. And this basically cuts off U.S. funding for any organization that even uses its own money to advocate to provide abortions or to advocate for abortions. For abortion rights within that country.
Moving along to something else now. Bill, I'd like to start with you on this as a longtime journalist professor as well as attorney. The discussion that we've been listening to for the last couple of weeks concerning that famous dossier on supposedly Donald Trump's improprieties while visiting Russia. It's gotten a lot of attention from news media, including BuzzFeed, which ran the whole dossier, if you will. Others just kind of synopsized it. What's your take on that with regard to the First Amendment, freedom of the press? Was BuzzFeed all right in publishing what it published? Just what is your take as a journalist on
well,
that?
Let me start with ethics. So ethically, as a journalist, I don't think that they should have published it because they hadn't been able to check it out. I mean, and it's ironic that BuzzFeed, which in the days just before and just after the election, had been so good about pointing out instances of fake news that had been influential in the campaign, you know, such as the Comet pizza story and that sort of thing, that had been, you know, largely very, very substantially in favor of the Trump candidacy. So BuzzFeed were the ones that then published this unverifiable information and was then subject to the counterattack very cleverly, you know, by the Trump administration of they are printing fake news. So, you know, as far as the First Amendment's concerned, I don't know. It seems like that probably Trump could not win a libel suit against them.
Because they prefaced their reporting by saying, we haven't been able to confirm this.
I mean, it's – yes, right. It's – I mean, it was a – you know, it was the document that was referred to in an attachment to an intelligence report. Yeah. So BuzzFeed would have some sort of defense to a libel suit. As much as Trump would probably like to file a libel suit, I can't really see the president doing something like that.
And what's so interesting about this is it's not a case of BuzzFeed rushing ahead with something that only they had, which they wanted to get out even before they could confirm it. This is something that news organizations, Congress, have had for months, and they've been trying to either, it seems like, prove or disprove what's contained within it, and they haven't been able to. And so that's why I thought your use of the word unverifiable was so interesting, because it's facts. It's meetings that did or did not happen, people who did or did not have conversations about things. And you would seem like it would seem like we could either say, yes, this happened, or no, it didn't happen.
Yeah. Well, I guess I should have said unverified. But given the fact that to actually prove things that happened in hotels in Moscow, they may be actually unverifiable, you know, given the circumstances. But you know, there are some journalists who defend what BuzzFeed did. You know, they say, well, okay, the whole country is talking about what was this addendum to the intelligence report on Trump and the Russians. And so, you know, are we just not going to help people out knowing what that's about? But I mean, my position is you don't publish it until you can verify it.
And that's what most journalists would say, don't you think?
Most journalists, but not all of them.
Yeah,
did.
But most would say bad journalism,
Jack
but protected Schaefer, by the First Amendment.
Jack Schaefer is a really well-known journalist for Politico right now, and he said he thought that they were right to publish it.
Two other things I want to get to as time will allow. And one is Jeff Sessions, who is the attorney general designate, has been testifying on Capitol Hill. And there's an interesting issue that has arisen with regard to that. He may be in a position as a sitting senator to be voting on some of the other fellow cabinet nominees before he is confirmed. And people are saying he should recuse himself because he'll be voting on people that he will be perhaps judging as attorney general, if I can put it that way. Right. Is there a case to be made there?
I guess there's a case to be made, but I sort of go along with Dick Durbin in Illinois, who is a Democrat and commented, he's in the Senate, he gets the vote, as long as he's in the Senate. It doesn't seem as though there are precedents necessarily that tell you one way or another. I think that my own opinion is that Sessions is a terrible choice to be Attorney General of the United States because he does not believe in key portions of the laws that he is going to be in charge of enforcing, civil rights laws involving police brutality, civil rights laws involving the right to vote. I could go on and on. The Roe versus Wade. I mean, what his answer to the committee has been, well, I don't believe in that, but I'll enforce it. Well, if you don't believe in the largest part of the mandate of the Justice Department, I think that's a problem.
And he's not the only cabinet nominee to be facing some of these tough ethics questions. You know, I think as we speak, there's a confirmation hearings on for Tom Price for HHS and Mick Mulvaney for OMB. And both of them have faced concerns about their stock purchases or failure to pay taxes, respectively, allegations that took down former cabinet nominees. So it'll be interesting to see how those play out.
One of the things we can get to is this is a subject that could take the entire hour, I'm sure, our famous emoluments issue. A suit has been filed in connection with that. That, of course, concerns the fact that President Trump now, because of his holdings, might be subject to some financial favors from foreign powers. The suit has been filed. Who would like to comment on that, the basis of the suit and the chances of success?
I'll just say real quickly that I think that this group, the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, that they that they have a good argument that money paid to the Trump Hotel and the Trump Organization, which Donald Trump still owns, that money could possibly be considered to be an emolument prohibited under the Constitution. Where I think they have a very, very, very weak argument is that they have standing to sue about this just because they had to divert all of their ethical work and from other areas to look at this ethics issue. I would be the most surprised person if the Supreme Court were to order to file an order requiring Donald Trump to abide by the emoluments clause. That's sort of a classic political question. Yeah. If Congress isn't going to make them do it, either through a law or through the impeachment process, the Supreme Court isn't likely to, in my opinion.
My understanding is that the Congress can, in fact, if it chooses to do so,
pass
simply
a law.
Just say, it's okay, we're not bothered by this. Rachel, you're chomping at the bit, it looks like.
Well, I'm not sure Congress could pass a law saying that violations of the Emoluments Clause are okay, right? They clearly couldn't do that.
They could say this is okay. In this case, it's okay.
But they could say fair market transactions are okay, couldn't they?
Well, the Emoluments Clause says without the consent of Congress.
Oh, okay, then yes.
So if Congress consents, He can do whatever they say. Yeah, they consent to.
I just want to disaggregate the points about standing and the political question doctrine because I think it's much clearer that there are certain individuals like rival hotels or other groups who would have standing to challenge. But the political question, the idea that you're going to have a court order the president to divest himself in this way is much more complicated. And so there might be these political question problems even if you can get past the standing hurdle. But these are very brilliant, high-powered attorneys, so I wouldn't count them out.
Right.
That's true.
I'm going to have to end it there. I should, in all fairness, say that the president has said that the suit is totally without merit. So that's where he's coming from.
There you go.
Surprise, surprise.
Without merit, not without standing.
Thank you all so much for being with us. Rachel Sachs, thank you. Pleasure meeting
you.
Please come back and visit us again. Mark Smith, great to see you. Bill Freivogel, as always, great to see you all. We'll see you in about a month. Thanks again.
Archived versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.